The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. We're going to start tonight with Dana Goodyear, who is known both for her sharp lyrical poetry as well as her prose, which you can read quite frequently in The New Yorker. Her most recent piece, which many of you, I'm sure, read, was a beautiful feature on the poet Gary Snyder that immerses you in Snyder's work and life philosophy. Dana is the author of Honey and Junk, a collection of poems which was published by Norton in 2005, and of which the poet J.D. McClatchy wrote, haunted, ruthless, tender, scary, cool, and edgy smart. And Yvonne Boland praised as a superb, brave first book of poetry, dropping the reading into extraordinary music and truth. Please welcome Dana Goodyear.
Thank you very much, Louise. I'm so happy to be here at the Central Library. I've been in the audience here many times, and it is a great honor, and I'm very grateful to the PSA as well for having me, and to be reading in this fine company is especially wonderful. I am going to take advantage of the high-tech. What do I do to push this up? This is a mechanical podium.
Yeah, it's this little toggle switch.
There. Okay, great. I'm okay, I think. Thank you. I'm first going to read a little bit from my book, and then I'm going to read a lot of new poems, some of which have never been read in public before. So feel free to give me feedback on those. The first poem I'm going to read is called Things Get Better Before They Get Worse. I find you drinking bourbon with a teenager. Let's not leave her out of this, or the fact that you don't drink. I command a river view, and like a widow, watch the boats. My roommates trot their babies out to make a wet nurse out of me. Are you listening? No time for that. Now let his hand go at the fat part of your leg. Now be a good girl and go back to bed. A stranger on the answering machine. I think I've got exactly what you're looking for. Tons of light, water on three sides. They ask after you at the garage. I tell them little lies. Over your dead body. This wasn't what you had in mind when you said, a house by the sea. This flat Japanese plan, this expanse that stubs on a bunker of grass, these swans hissing humans off the nest, and Vitex, the abortion tree, scratching at the window screen. I don't think my mother was part of your ideal, or this dinner of wet chicken, lobster, and gin. You meant Sweden, a kind of sober heaven where you wouldn't have to think about God. Stay, stunt love, if you can stand it here. Soon your double body will be nobody, no more. I think I can safely read the next few poems because I'm not related by blood to anybody in the audience. I always have to check. Raised by aliens. I come to in an avocado tub. Cuyahoga, Vita Bath, 6 o'clock, a Saturday, the comet year. Through the sliding glass, I see a field of igloos and a straining dog who can't come in. because his rope-red tail thrashes the majolica from every high-shine demi-lune. Mother's vacuuming, a black hole, knowing nothing happens here. Her eyeshadow, a gibbous moon. In an astro, I become a flickering defibrillator storm. Father in his glowing mask. He was 40. I was born. County Line Road. Who was father? A bandage, a mustache, from time to time, a saddening salt and pepper beard. Mother? Some sort of monger. I see her with a pink fish, my body weight, dill hairs clinging to her hands. Daddy is tired, I am said to have said, and then I'd sing to him, sleeping. He was an athlete, dislocated. He said, forget me not. Mother was never in the same room with any of us. I think she was a hostess, in which case I should say, thank you for having me. This next poem, the title is taken from the name of a recipe in a cookbook I have. Second Marriage Pork. The first short section is called Petra. The girl has everything. German measles, slender limbs, access to pornography, a box of gold butt cigarettes, a flat. A mother wearing diamonds in the kitchen after dark, saying shatsi putsi while she heats the bedtime milk. Second short section is called The Muse House. My mother's making second marriage pork, food of newlyweds. The I've gone to live with Petra note has gone unread. A yellow nightie in the window of the temporary third floor room is risen like a honeymoon. Oasis. This is a poem that I wrote about the same place that someone who capitalized on the experience a great deal more than I did wrote The Player about. Was that sentence hard to follow? I think it was. I'll leave it at that, though. Oasis. We found like the deserting spacious calm, drank a pair of Arnold Palmers underneath a palm, went for massage and mud, lacquer, love, overheated minerals, a stimulating rub. Then, as if it could be used, as if for art, I placed a grain of doubt in your open poured heart and watched what had been small dilate and everything else evaporate. The next poem I'm going to read is part of a group of poems I've been working on that are imperfect, but attempts at writing sapphics, which is not really advisable in English. They don't really usually work very well, and I'm not saying I have overcome the classic difficulty of rendering in English those Greek that Greek meter, but it was interesting to me to try, and what it forced me to do with language was curious for me. This is called Wedding Month. And I should say also that I was drawn to do this because a long time ago I spent a summer translating the Sapphic fragments in the one complete poem that we have by Sappho, and I never really let that work influence the poems I was writing, but before I got married a year and a half ago, I started thinking about those Sapphic fragments again, because of course they're so associated with the love between women, but a lot of the poems are actually about marriage and in celebration of marriage. So that and the enormous production that goes on in preparing for a wedding. So that's kind of how I came to work in this form, and then I'll read another one later that shows that my interest in it is not limited to the sort of wedding song aspect of Sappho. Wedding Month. Moving forest, nurseryman, stagehands, April. Grafting life on mineral patches, masking empty ground they cultivate. We will, carpenters at noon. We find grave goods digging in garden trenches, greenish marble, maculate like a lost eye. Dog bones, dog's bones, delicate skull in hefty burial plastic. Arson, drifter, cigarette, Griffith Park alive with flickers. Mystery water floods the pulsing green in Argentine yard. Coyotes, married in 4 days. The Gravel Garden. This is about a famous Zen garden in Kyoto that everybody, if you think of the words Zen garden, you will be imagining this garden because it's pretty much the only one anyone has ever seen. And it's certainly of the several that I've seen, the one that I remember because I was preconditioned to remember it by having seen so many images of it before I actually saw it. The Gravel Garden. We sat in the gallery looking at rocks. Tigers swimming, mother and child, corpse. I thought of one angry monk saying, sweep. Another teasing. So many configurations. The idea being, a speck turns vast if you stare long enough. We were 1 week married. Here, in the opposite of Eden, in the dry peace of no fruit, 25 meters or infinity. Elegy. The hypnotist woke up on the warm lawn of a borrowed house, with wild strawberries being forced into his mouth by a woman with split ends and coral knuckles and dark rings around the light parts of her eyes. He missed her already, and they had only just met. Her daughters weren't born. She would harm them. He could see it all now. A mother only sons could love. He could see it all now. She would wear that bikini for the next 100 years. When she went, they'd circle like birds. Her woven hair, the brittle nest her body had become. I've gotten really interested in my neighbors since moving to Los Angeles, and it might be my neighborhood, which is in transition. It used to be kind of a gritty, sort of it's Hollywood. A lot of people moved into the neighborhood in the 40s and 50s, and some of those people are still there, but they actually, even in the 4 years that I've been there, I've seen several of them die, and when this has happened, the stories that emerge about their lives and their interconnectedness have really been fascinating. So this is actually a story about one of my neighbors who died. It's called Next. The message of even those raised from seed, their small hands blasphemers, overloved for what they are, overlooked at. Watch me go. We were digging the bed when a woman appeared at the gate, her face torqued red, crying open-mouthed and silently. Do you know Angela, she said. Angela is dead. Later, we heard about her gold teeth out, a cup of golden liquid underneath her bed. I learned nasturtium comes from twisted nose, then found two deep ruts around the roots, the strangled faces touched but silent, saying someone has been here. And inside our spotless house, three white worms curling in an ecstasy of everything they know. The Rains. She lived in this house alone with both her breasts cut off and a lover who was 30 growing pot in her back shed. Performed for her friends, Lily Marlene, green sleeves and swing low. Kept the letter Audrey Hepburn sent. Loved women and men. Was disowned. In a downpour, saw a gushing pipe and called out, make it stop. Died and started singing in our sleep. Go read just a few more. So these are these next two are sapphics that are getting more into the territory of pornography, which also is sort of a motif of Sappho. If you want to think about it that way, I don't, but some people think it is. But these poems are definitely about pornography. They sort of originated with, there's a house that I pass a lot, and I've always been interested in it because it is this mysterious, always shuttered for a while. There were just sheets in the windows, and then they must have made some money, and they hired some carpenters and put up shutters, and but they're always closed, but there also are always about five really, really super fancy cars pulled up to this house, and then parked all along the streets are maybe 10 or 15 really crummy cars with out-of-state plates, so I have my theories. This is called 8100 Block. Cars and trucks of gardeners, dealers, young girls, fast food bags and pregnancy tests, one beat shoe, canyon wasteland dangling over it all, derelict back road. Car comes, parks in parallel, front seat, MapQuest. Bumper sticker, Canada, Wild Rose Country. this far, what now, pussycat? Go back? Think not. Run away, you're home. Follows path of whiskery, thin-nosed, dead leaves, thinks father thoughts. Perishing lemons on trees, shrunken, inward. Realizes this must be it. Turning point. She turns. And this one, I kind of eroded the sapphic form a little bit, but it did start, the idea is a sapphic with blank space where there should be words. soft core. Couple giggling teenagers slowly driving, out of state white Acura, God's eye dangling. Shutters open. Finally, flat screen, leather, muscular goatee. Stage direction, bring your pussy. Easy, easy. Action. Comes down to this, hesitant girl sex. Bungalow secret. I will just read one more poem called The Bowerbirds. As if we were leaving the small forest tower that we built with a moss carpet and mosquito chandeliers and laughing at it. I can't believe you used that word in an argument, no less. But we would never break this way, loose, affectionate, wry. You straighten, add an ornament. This is somehow part of our staying. If you left, a black cape would flap like a crow winging, and I would make 100 harried calls. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dana. Next, we're going to hear from Timothy Steele, whose poems are characterized by their wit, musicality, shapeliness, as well as the charity and the clarity of his vision. Timothy is the author of 4 collections of poetry, including Uncertainties and Rest, Sapphics Against Anger, and other poems, so the sapphics will reappear, The Color Wheel, and most recently, Toward the Winter Solstice. Timothy Steele is also an exceptional critic. He's the author of a scholarly study of poetic modernism, Missing Measures, Modern Poetry, and the Revolt Against Meter. And his other prose includes All the Funds and How You Say a Thing, An Explanation of Meter and Versification, which is designed as a practical investigation of metrics. He has many honors to his credit, including a Guggenheim and a Levon Younger Poets Award from the Academy of American Poets. And since 1987, he's been a professor of English at Cal State University, Los Angeles. Please welcome Timothy Steele.
The magic lectern. Thank you, Louise, for that very nice introduction, and I'd like to thank Rob as well, Rob Casper, for arranging this event. It's a pleasure to read with Dana and with Mark tonight, and thank you all for coming. The first poem I'll read has a local setting. It describes Benedict Canyon at daybreak. My wife and I live on the western edge of the canyon, and some mornings I'll go out after getting up, and the canyon will have filled with fog, having rolled up from the ocean. And it's quite a striking sight. Everything is submerged except for a few hills here and there showing like islands on the opposite side. It's quite a beautiful sight, but it's a little eerie and unsettling, too, in ways that the poem tries to suggest. Daybreak, Benedict Canyon. Thick fog has filled the canyon overnight and turned it to a sea of milky gray. The steep-sloped chaparral and streets below are drowned from view. Hilltops across the way form a low-lying archipelago upon the fog's smothering gulfs and shoals. The scene, in the uncertain pre-dawn light, recalls those Chinese landscapes on silk scrolls in which mists haunt ravines and clouds surround remote peaks fading to remoter skies. The scene suggests, too, the apocalypse the earth may suffer if sea levels rise. This very deck could be a ghostly ship's. And I, a lone survivor, cast by fate out on a flood as lifeless and profound as the one Noah had to navigate. Yet soon this world's specifics will revive and banish fanciful analogies. Some mourning doves on airily whistling wings will light in canyon overhanging trees. Damp breeze will test the tensile strength of strings, jeweled and soaking, that a spider's spun. Cars snaking up along Mulholland Drive will flash their windows at the rising sun. The fog will drain. The canyon will evince toyon, buckthorn, and yucca, and restore the ceanothus thickets that hide deer. Houses will surface on the canyon floor. The only ocean will be south of here and glimpsed through a green hollow in a ridge. Pacific in its sunny sparks and glints beyond San Pedro's Vincent Thomas Bridge. A while ago, I was traveling in the South and changed planes in the Memphis airport. And while passing through the terminal, I noticed a little bird up on a beam at the entrance to a concourse. Over the years, I've seen birds in parking garages and airport terminals, but they've usually been of common varieties, gulls, pigeons, sparrows. This one was a little different, and its difference and the fact that it was late March struck me and made its plight seem especially poignant when all the other birds were migrating. And when I came back to Los Angeles, I wrote this poem in the Memphis airport. Above the concourse, from a beam, a little warbler pours forth song. Beneath him, hurried humans stream. Some draw wheeled suitcases along, or from a beeping belt or purse, apply a cell phone to an ear. Some pause at banks of monitors where times and gates for flights appear. Although by nature flight endowed, he seems too gentle to reproach these souls who soon will climb through cloud in first class, business class, and coach. He may feel that it's his mistake he's here, but someone ought to bring a net to catch and help him make his own connections north to spring. He cheeps and trills on, swift and sweet, though no one outside hears his strains. There, telescopic tunnels greet the cheeks of their arriving planes. A ground crew welcomes and assists luggage that skycaps, treating bags like careful ornithologists banded with destination tags. Those first two poems are, as you could probably hear in the workhorse meters of English language poetry, the first was in iambic pentameter and that one was in iambic tetrameter. This next poem is in the stanza that Dana mentioned and so nicely read from just a moment ago, the sapphic stanza, the stanza that was popularized by and named after the ancient Greek poet Sappho, who lived in the 6th century BC. As Dana mentioned, its rhythms generally and particularly are not easily adaptable to English. You can only approximate them, but it offers different tonalities than the traditional instrument does, and we poets are always looking for different tones in different subjects, and it's fun to play around with. This particular poem in sapphic stanzas has details that reflect its domestic genesis. Some years ago, I came home one evening and had a pretty rough day and was complaining to my wife, Vicky, about the various sufferings I'd undergone. And we were newly wed at the time, and I think I was expecting an outpouring of sympathy when she very gently and nicely but firmly told me that I was behaving in a pretty immature manner, which was true. Loving her as I did and do, I was terribly embarrassed, but when my mortification subsided, I wrote this poem as a kind of act of penance. It mentions a couple literary heavy hitters, Aristotle and Virgil and Dante going through hell in the Divine Comedy. As I remember, because I was writing in this classical stanza, it seemed appropriate to bring in a couple writers who were themselves classics, but I hope it's clear they're not invoked in a spirit of venerable solemnity, but in a mock humorous fashion. Sapphics against anger. Angered, may I be near a glass of water. May my first impulse be to think of silence, its deities. Who are they? Do in fact they exist, etc. May I recall what Aristotle says of the subject. To give vent to rage is not to release it, but to be increasingly prone to its incursions. May I imagine being in the inferno, hearing it asked, Virgilio mio, who's that sulking with Achilles there? And hearing Virgil say, Dante, that fellow, at the slightest provocation, slammed phone receivers down and waved his arms like a madman. What Attila did to Europe, what Genghis Khan did to Asia, that poor dope did to his marriage. May I, that is, put learning to good purpose, mindful that melancholy is a sin, though stylish at present. Better than rage is the post-dinner quiet, the sink's warm turbulence, the streaming platters, the suds rehearsing down the drain in spirals in the last rinsing. For what is, after all, the good life, save that conducted thoughtfully? And what is passion, if not the holiest of powers, sustaining only if mastered? And that last line remains to this day a terrible reproach. I haven't been able to master it, but one tries. This next poem is descriptive. It just relates a picture of a boy practicing basketball by himself at a court on an outdoor playground. I should mention that early in the poem I used the word fainting. That's fainting spelled with an E rather than an A, to faint, to make a deceptive movement rather than to pass out. One thing anybody who presents something orally learns very quickly is that the tens of thousands of words that make up a language are comprised of a very small group of sounds. Linguists say they're roughly between 25 and 65, depending upon the given language. So a lot of words sound very similar or even identical. Practice. The basketball you walk around the court produces a hard, stinging, clean report. You pause and crouch, and after fainting, swoop around a ghost defender to the hoop and rise and lay the ball in off the board. Solitude, plainly, is its own reward. The game that you've conceived engrosses you. The ball rolls off. You fetch it and renew the dribble to the level of your waist. Ensuring that a sneaker is tightly laced, you kneel. Then up again, weave easily through obstacles that you alone can see. And so I drop the hands I'd just now cupped to call you home. Why should I interrupt? Can I be sure that dinner's ready yet? A jump shot settles, snapping through the net. The backboard stanchion keeps the ball in play, returning it to you on the ricochet. And I'll read two more poems. This one concerns the idea of a golden age, the idea that there was a time when, thanks to God's favor or lucky circumstances, things were much better for people than they are today. Sometimes the golden age is conceived as a religious myth, the Garden of Eden before the fall, for instance, and sometimes it's presented as a particular historical period, Renaissance Florence, say, or the Pericles of Athens. I think what the poem tries to say is there's really never been a golden age, and given the conditions of life, probably never could be, and that if humanity prevails at any particular time, it's not because of fortunate deity or mere luck, but because individual men and women have the heart and the guts to be kind and thoughtful and honest. Golden Age. Even in fortunate times, the nectar is spiked with woe. Gods are incorrigibly capricious, and the needy beg in Nineveh or sleep in paper-gusting plazas of the New World's shopping malls. Meantime, the tyrant battens on conquest, while advisors, angling for preferment, seek expedient paths. Heartbroken, the faithful advocate looks back on cities of the plain and trudges into exile. And if any era thrives, it's only because somewhere in a plane tree's shade, friends sketch the dust with theorems and proofs. Or because instinctively, a man puts his arm around the shoulder of grief and walks it for an hour or an age through all its tears and telling. And I'll close with another Los Angeles poem, and a seasonal one at that. One evening some years ago at this time, I was stringing holiday lights up into a birch tree in front of our house. We were at the time living over in the Roberts and Pico area, and I would go up at this time of year on the roof, and with a long pole, a dowel, would cast lights into the tree and then sort of move it around in a way that I hoped would make it look attractive when the lights came on. If you know the area, lots of little shops, houses, and neighbors would come by and friends would come by in the evening as I was doing this. And one particular night, as darkness was falling, I looked across town and saw lights elsewhere, and it struck me that in this vast and multicultural and multi-faith community, we all had some kind of way of acknowledging and celebrating this time of year as we approached the solstice, and all did something in one way or another to assert the power and beauty of light in this time of darkness. This was the starting point of the poem, and other things came in later. I should mention that toward the end of the poem, there are two out-of-the-way words, which I hope are justified by the context and which I should probably gloss. One of them is caravansary, a nice Persian word meaning an inn for travelers, literally a hostel on a caravan route, and the other is a word from French, a ceinture, meaning ornamental belt or waistband, and thinking of the lights as being banded around the tree. You probably know those words, but if you're like me, when you're listening to someone reading something, it's hard to register some things as they go by you. Toward the winter solstice. Although the roof is just a story high, it dizzies me a little to look down. I lariat twirl the cord of Christmas lights and cast it to the weeping birch's crown. A dowel into which I've screwed a hook enables me to reach, lift, drape, and twine the cord among the boughs so that the bulbs will accent the tree's elegant design. Friends passing home from work or shopping pause and call up commendations or critiques. I make adjustments. Though a potpourri of Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and Sikhs, we all are conscious of the time of year. We all enjoy its colorful displays and keep some festival that mitigates the dwindling warmth and compass of the days. Some say that LA doesn't suit the Yule, but UPS vans now, like magi, make their present-laden rounds, while fallen leaves are gaily resurrected in their wake. The desert lifts a full moon from the east and issues a dry Santa Ana breeze, and valets at chic restaurants will soon be tending flocks of cars and SUVs. And as the neighborhoods sink into dusk, the fan palms scattered all across town stand more calmly prominent, and this place seems a vast oasis in the Holy Land. This house might be a caravansary, the tree a kind of cordial fountainhead of welcome, looped and decked with necklaces and ceinctures of green, yellow, blue, and red. Some wonder if the Star of Bethlehem occurred when Jupiter and Saturn crossed. It's comforting to look up from this roof and feel that while all changes, nothing's lost. to recollect that in antiquity, the winter solstice fell in Capricorn, and that in the Orion Nebula, from swirling gas, new stars are being born. Thank you very much.
Thank you both so much, Dana and Timothy. It's nice until I stop and hear poetry, I don't realize how much I need poetry, and I really thank you both so much. It's very necessary. Our third reader tonight is our out-of-town guest, Mark Doty, who is the John and Rebecca Moores Professor in the Graduate Program at the University of Houston. And Mark is the author of many books of poetry and prose, and his work has been honored with many awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award, the LA Times Book Prize. He's the only American poet to have received the T.S. Eliot Prize in the UK. And tonight, we can celebrate him as the 2008 National Book Award winner in poetry. So very honored to have him here. He's fresh from the ceremony. I've seen it on Facebook. From the judge's citation, elegant, plain-spoken, and unflinching. That's a really good word for Mark. Mark Doty's poems, In Fire to Fire, gently invite us to share their ferocious compassion with their praise for the world and their fierce accusation, their defiance and applause. They combine grief and glory in a music of crazy excelsis. In this generous retrospective volume, a gifted young poet has become a master. And the only thing I can add to that is I just have to say I spent one of the most deeply pleasurable, memorable afternoons of my life sitting in a cafe in Krakow, Poland, reading Mark's beautiful book, Still Life with lemons and oysters, which is my all-time favorite treatise on life and art, and which I reread as necessary. His work is very necessary. Please welcome Mark Doty.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to read with Dana and Tim. I want to thank my hosts in particular for this podium. Rescued from the set of Plan 9 from outer space. And I don't know how you make it do anything, so I just won't. I don't. I just was looking forward to playing with it, but I'm not going to do that. I am going to begin with a few new poems. And the first of these is set in Houston, where I teach. And Houston has in common with Los Angeles the fact that nobody walks anywhere. And if you are in a position to walk in Houston, you encounter the very poor and the recently deinstitutionalized, usually. I had this experience. My car was in the shop. During the build-up to the recent election, and I had been thinking at that time about the American propensity to believe practically anything, that a state, a fantastic sort of private visionary claim would be made, emailed, and immediately taken up by many others. This is called half-price books. I'm walking past the discount bookstore toward the battered corner, in the city where no one walks but the damaged poor. And a gentleman, reasonably dressed, sitting in an open shelter where you wait for the bus, looks at me squarely and says, "No matter what you say, I'm going to go on praying to Jesus and his big ass." You can already guess where I'm going with this. The way we're all receiving and declaiming our own peculiar messages, just not quite so overtly. And how's what I'm doing here any different from the fellow in that hot Houston morning saying the words I've just committed to print? But I want to go back to that bookstore. There's a reason those books are marked down. I'm surprised they don't just give them away. A million ridiculous things are being said every minute. Our own cracked, solitary apprehension of God's personal message whispered in our ears only, and we need you or someone to hear what he says. My man on Westheimer has given a mighty attribute to his Lord. The world, says Wordsworth, is what we perceive and half create. We believe this in America. If I wrote half that book, why should I pay you full price?
So this is very new, meaning that if you should you chance to see it again, it might look quite different. The poem harkens back to the wonderful opening stanza of section 6 of Song of Myself, when Whitman says, a child said, what is the grass, fetching it to me with full hands? How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. What is the grass? On the margin, in the used text I've purchased without opening, pale, green, dutiful vessel for a gospel of liberation, some unconvinced student has written, in a clear, looping hand, isn't it grass? How could I answer the child? I do not exaggerate. I think of her question for years. And while first I imagine her the very type of the incurious, revealing the difference between a mind at rest and one that cannot, later I come to imagine that she had faith in language. That was the difference. She believed that the word settled things. The matter need not be looked into again. And he who'd written his book over and over, nearly ruining it, so enchanted was he by what had first compelled him. For him, the word settled nothing at all. And this one takes for its title the notion of immanence, the idea, of course, that God is omnipresent, implicated in all of reality. Immanence. My lover says he likes to ride on the top level of the George Washington Bridge, because then he's closer to his Lord. I say, but isn't God immanent? And he says, that's true too. And I say, well, how can you be any closer then? He enjoys the mystery of contradiction, likes being lifted up, while I think the highest level of the bridge is terrifying. I act as though I am brave because I understand that it's beautiful up here, shockingly so, April pouring its gold over the gathered Hudson. But still, I think of Rilke saying beauty's the beginning of a terror we can hardly bear. My friend would say it's the other way around. Terror, the beginning of some radical beauty. And he's happy while I drive the appalling, crowded lane. And he looks out over the edges, humming a little, entirely pleased. Well, the new poems in this book, Fire to Fire, have a title of their own. The section is called Theories and Apparitions. And I thought I would read you some of the apparitions, which are poems that involve the intrusion of poets of the past into the present moment, sometimes in unexpected forms. Apparition, favorite poem. The old words are dying. Everyone forgets them. Pages falling into sleep and dust, dust and sleep,
burning so slowly you wouldn't even know there's a fire. Or that's what I think half the time. Then, at the bookstore, a young man reciting. Slight for 14, blonde, without irony, but not self-important either. His loping East Texas vowels threaten to escape the fence of pentameter. His voice seems to have just arrived here, but the old cadence inhabits anyway. He makes the poem his own, even as he becomes a vessel for its reluctance to disappear. All right, maybe they perish, but the boy has the look of someone repeating a crucial instruction that must be delivered word for word as he has learned it. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. So I read that poem in Houston a few nights ago, and that boy came to the reading with his parents, and they bought 6 copies of the book for, you know, all their relatives. It's adorable. Sometimes when we write about people, we're not so lucky that they, you know, respond to it so positively. So, apparition. Chilly noon on 7th, and I swear, in the window of the Eros Diner, corner of 21st Street, John Berryman's eating alone. Back against the wall, face tilted down toward his meal, iconic thick glasses glinting like the sidewalk in the cold, iconic thick beard nodding a little as he lifts his spoon, intent on lunch, so happy that a plate's in front of him, he never bothers to look up at me. And this apparition demonstrates that my sympathies are sapphic, while my stanzas are not. Apparition. Handsome chest thick with white hair cropped close. The pleasant man leans the stacked solid volume of himself back to rest, reclining on his pillows. And I sit back on my knees to take stock of him. But the look sucks the breath out of me. He is gazing in my direction with a pleased half-smile, eyes a little out of focus, as though I'm seeing him or he views me through a kind of gauze. And he isn't the man I know, slightly, but plain as early winter daylight across the Hudson, the impossible, gentle, manly visionary of the 1850s. Bowl-cut hair, warm lines around the eyes, dilated as by an opiate, what shines in and out of them in equal proportion. That's the Walt Whitman who has come to look at me, curiously, on a mild November afternoon on the west side of Midtown. In this apparition, I'm happy to say, the quotation from Charles Darwin is for real. Apparition. Oracular pair, this peacock perched in a plywood roost at the garden center. Magnificent behind a wire fence marked with his name, Homer, and hand-lettered instructions, "Don't provoke me." He's the provocation. Of what use the wrought extravagance he's not just now displaying? Darwin, the sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. No reason on earth, even eons of increments, would conspire to this. And is the peahen that hard to attract? Requiring an arc of nervous gleams, 100 shining animals symmetrically peering from the dim primeval woods. But if Homer argues by his mere presence for creation, his deity's a little hysteric. Rampant attitude contained in all that glory. Did he who made the lamb make this imperious metallic topknot shivering above an emerald field of anodized aluminum while Homer blinks and flicks his actual eyes from side to side? And then the epic trombone slide from Mars cry no human throat can mime. Is that why it stops the heart? Just before he condescends to unfurl the archaic poem of his tale. So after the book had gone to press, I received another apparition. So this is the last one. And the poet here is the late Alan Dugan, marvelous, underread, cranky bohemian who won the Pulitzer for his first book and then spent the next 40 years in a kind of antagonism to the poetry world. Apparition. Bitter wind off the metal harbor, and here's Dugan crossing 15th Street as if he owned it. Sharp new jacket, just the shade of that riffled steel. Why shouldn't the dead sport a little style? Once, at a dinner in his honor, I watched bored Dugan take out a pair of clippers and begin to trim his nails, till a fat yellow paring flew and landed on the plate of his publisher's wife, who screamed. Then the recalcitrant old boho grew courtly, and with a smile that may have been sincere, managed to convince her he was a gentleman after all. And here he is, in the afterlife, big glasses gleaming, standing up straight as he never could in the years I knew him, no chip on his shoulder. You can tell by the shiny jacket, he's over all that now. Okay, two more poems. One morning, one very cold, lockdown winter morning, I was driving in Jersey City, and I came upon a beauty parlor that seemed to have just been set aflame. House of Beauty. In Jersey City, Antonelli Avenue, the House of Beauty is burning. On a Sunday morning in January, under the chilly shadow of the Pulaski Skyway, the House of Beauty is burning. Who lobbed the fire bottle through the glass, in among the creams and thrones, the helmets and clippers and combs? Who set the House of Beauty burning? In the dark recess beside the sink, where heads lay back to be laved, under the perfected heads rode along the walls, the hopeful photographs of possibility darken now that the House of Beauty is burning. The skyway beetles in the ringing cold, trestle arcing the steel river in warehouses, truck lots and Indian groceries, a new plume of smoke joining the others, billow of dark thought rising from the broken forehead of the House of Beauty. An omission almost too small to notice just now. Alarm still ringing, the flames new launched on their project of ruining an effort at pleasure, glass jutting like cracked ice in the window frame. No one inside. The fire department on the way. All things by nature, wrote Virgil, are ready to get worse. No surprise, then, that the House of Beauty is burning. Though whatever happens, however far these fires proceed, reducing history to powder, Whatever the House of Beauty made is untouchable now. Nothing can undo so many heads made lovely, or at least acceptable. So much shapelessness given what are called permanence, though nothing holds a fixed form. Bring on the flames. What does it matter if the house is burning? Propose a new beauty, perennially unhoused. Neither the lost things nor the fire itself, but the objects in their dresses of disaster. Anything clothed in its own passage. Padded vinyl chair burst into smoky tongues. Lucite helmet sagged to a new version of its form. Our black bridge, a charred rainbow on iron legs, two ruby eyes glowering in its crown. If beauty is burning, what could you save? The House of Beauty is a house of flames. So I'm happy to report that they seem to have done very well with the insurance money, because the House of Beauty is now reopened. Looks great, bigger than ever. All right, well, I'm going to end. I know there's many a poet in the room this evening, so I'm going to end with a poem which is particularly for writers. It's a poem that began in Britain. In Herefordshire, out in the west of England, when I had been out to dinner with some friends, and we came out of a little country inn, and one of my friends said, "Look," and there was a little pipistrelle, a little European bat, flying overhead. And we all looked, and of course there was nothing there. And someone else said, "Look," and we all looked, and there was nothing there. And it immediately became apparent, you know, we could not see this thing at the same time. Only one person could see him at a time. And in our company, there were two poets, a fiction writer, a literary critic, and I knew that within a week, there would be at least two poems about this experience, and here's one of them. Pipistrelle. His music, Charles writes, makes us avoidable. I write Emissary of Evening. We're writing poems about last night's bat. Charles has stripped the scene to lyric, while I'm filling in the tale. How, when we emerged from the inn, an unassuming place in the countryside near Horwithy, not far from the Wye, two twilight mares in a thorn hedge field across the road, clotted cream and raw gray wool, vaguely above it all, came a little closer. Though when we approached, they ignored us and went on softly tearing up audible mouthfuls. So we turned in the other direction, toward Lothpool, a mud hole scattered with sticks beneath an ancient conifer's vast trunk. Then Charles saw the quick ambassador fret the spaces between boughs with an inky signature too fast to trace. We turned our faces upward, trying to read the deepening blue between black limbs. And he said again, "There he is," though it seemed only one of us could see the fluttering pipistrelle at a time. You'd turn your head to where he'd been. No luck, he'd already joined a larger dark. "There he is," Paul said it, then Pippa. Then I caught the fleeting contraption speeding into a bank of leaves and heard the high two-syllabled piping. But when I said what I'd heard, no one else had noticed it. And Charles said, "Only some people can hear their frequencies." 50 years old, and I didn't know I could hear the tender cry of a bat. Cry won't do. A diminutive chime somewhere between merriment and weeping. Who could ever say? I, with no music to my name, save what I can coax into a line, no sense of pitch, heard the night's own one-sided conversation. What to make of the gift? An oddity, like being double-jointed? Or token of some kinship to the little Victorian handbag dashing between the dim bulks of trees. Of course, the next day, we begin our poems. Charles considers the pipistrelle's music navigational, a modest, rational understanding of what I have decided is my personal visitation. Is it because I am an American, I think the bat came especially to address me, who have the particular gift of hearing him? If he sang to us, but only I heard him, does that mean he sang to me? Or does that mean that I am a son of Whitman, while Charles is an heir of Wordsworth, albeit, thankfully, a more concise one? Is this material necessary or helpful to my poem? Even though Charles admires my welter of detail, my branching questions, couldn't I compose a lean, meditative evocation of what threaded over our wondering heads? Or do I need to do what I am doing now and worry my little aerial friend with a freight not precisely his? Does the poem reside in experience or in self-consciousness about experience? Shh, says the evening near the Y. Enough, say the hungry horses. Listen to my poem, says Charles. A word in your ear, says the night. Thanks very much.
Thank you.